Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Welcome to the greatest movie show on the internet and possibly television, radio, and film itself. So,
That
was a great introduction, man. I mean, that was, like, very passionate. It was like Orson Welles, like, yelling at the people when he's making that frozen peas commercial.
That's a beautiful analogy. I just want to point out, our chat room is open for those of you listening on remote locations or on the homepage or wherever you're listening and you're wondering, hey, are there other people out there like me? There are, and they're in the chat room. And Nostradamus just entered the chat room, and I predicted he would. So we're glad to see him there.
And Jason O'Brien's there, too, so, I mean, you know.
Yeah, what else do we need, really?
A stiff drink.
It's a great show. This is Movie Geeks United on Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio had a big day today, and I want to make mention of it at the top here.
Okay, yeah, let's do it.
They brought on President Obama,
mm-hmm.
Because Obama's always been one to embrace social media and different new forms of interaction, and so he chose Blog Talk Radio, and that says a lot about the platform that he did that. He came on to talk about healthcare reform, and it was great. So for any of you guys that are discovering us for the first time because you first visited the website to hear Obama, welcome. And thank you all for joining us.
This is like, you know, I had a guy at my work yesterday who, you know, is skeptical of the whole platform. He is like, well, how do you get these guests and everything? You're only on Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, this is what I put up with. I mean, you know, I put up with a lot of stuff, but you're only on Blog Talk Radio. And, you know, then like the day after that, the big announcement is that President Obama is going to be on BTR. Well, I couldn't think of a better advertisement
for
a new medium, and also from someone who has embraced the new technology for most of his career.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a great week for BTR, and hopefully, you know, first of many great weeks for them.
They're in the mainstream big time now.
Yeah.
As if we didn't put them there enough, now they have President Obama's support.
That's right. So. That's absolutely right. We are. No, dude, got it. No, I mean, you know, what more could you ask for? I mean, we've had a little over two years, you know, we've had some pretty big name guests, not just in the terms of film geekdom and that sort of stuff, but mainstream. I mean, we've had Dana Delaney on the show. You know, we've had Bob. We were about to have Bobcat on. We've had Coppola. I mean, we just had these big names, and we're
going
to have them.
I think about like the legends, the people that we love, the Coppolas and Schraders and De Palma.
Oh, yeah.
Those interviews are so rare with De Palma and Schrader, particularly. Those are real highlights.
The Schrader one is just something I think everyone should listen to because it's not something you're going to get anywhere else. What he talks about, the jumping around, and, you know, very honest, a very candid conversation from him, perhaps more candid than I was prepared for, in a good way. So, go through the archives because you're going to find a lot of great stuff.
Yes, and since our good friend Jason O'Brien says I never give him a shout-out, if you're new to the show and you love movies, there are other movie shows as well after you're done listening to all of our 214 shows. Do you know that this is our 214th show?
Dude, that's awesome. We've been at it, and hopefully another 214 after this. So, you know, Oscar. You want to go listen to Oscar, and it's the 2001 tribute show from the other night.
That's the last one he did. It's blogtalkradio.com/OscarOscar. Go to it after this show. It'll whet your appetite for more, I guess. So Bobcat Goldthwait. Let's talk about him a little bit and his new movie, World's Greatest Dad.
Mm-hmm.
We both watched it prior to the interview,
mm-hmm.
and we were both surprised at just how brilliant it is. I mean, it's very good.
It's very good. It's you know, it's not. I think for the someone who only knows him, let's say from his stand up or like from Shakes the Clown or all right, let's just say the Police Academy movies, it will surprise
right.
you. It will surprise you. I watched it with the inspiration for World's Greatest Dad, my dad, and that is sarcasm, folks, if you didn't know that. And trying to get him to watch it for the first half hour was a challenge as it was, but no, he actually liked it too. But it's a really good movie, and if you have on demand, and I would really strongly recommend you watch it.
Mm-hmm.
It will knock your socks off, and I don't normally say that. I don't like to preach, but this one will do that. It will surprise you.
Yeah, and it's very delicately toned. It's not what you'd expect. It's very surprising. So the you're going to hear about inspirations and certain things in the movie from Bobcat tonight, but it's good to go in as cold as possible because
mm-hmm.
I knew the title, I knew the rough outline of what the plot was, but I was shocked by the sincerity of it and
mm-hmm.
the power of it.
Yeah.
And also, it should be said, it contains one of Robin Williams' best performances.
In a very long time.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. It's a good one. So let's hear Bobcat Goldthwait, our conversation with him. He was very funny. And as befitting any outrageous comedian such as himself, I have to warn you, it does have a smidge of language. I like
mm-hmm.
to put that up top, you know, just to give our people an advance warning from now on. But it's a great, fun, exciting, insightful conversation. Here is Bobcat.
Negro, I may be young, but I'm not your boy. I won't pick your cotton or pick up your dishes. Yeah, I say, I am not your monkey.
I don't.
Stay black, y'all.
Anybody else have their haiku? My name is Lance Clayton. I'm a writer. But so far, nothing I've written has ever been published. Ernest Hemingway once said, all he wanted to do was write one true sentence. He also tried to scratch an itch in the back of his head with a shotgun.
Your poetry course is not very popular.
It is poetry, sir.
Does it bother you that I am male friends?
Not at all. Why don't we do something together tomorrow?
Yeah, like build a rocket?
Sure, if you want to.
That's retarded.
Yeah. Just 9:30, we can go to a video store, get a movie.
Are you stupid? I hate watching movies.
Carl's a complex guy. Put on some music you like, Carl, okay?
No, I hate music.
You hate music?
Yeah.
All music?
No, the only thing queer than music are the people who like it.
How's Carl been acting at home?
Are you on your period or something?
Does he seem normal to you?
Oh, yeah. We're going out to dinner tonight with Claire.
What? No.
If you don't act right at dinner, I'll stab you in the face.
So, what do you like to do, Kyle?
Nothing.
You must like to do something.
No.
Well, Kyle doesn't like me.
Oh, no. He likes you a lot.
You don't look so good.
Well, I had kind of a rough weekend.
Kyle, you ruin everything. Will you just shut up?
They're not kidding when they say that raising a child is the toughest job you'll ever lose.
I thought he was a zombie.
I wish. I like zombies.
We both adore your movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you.
It was really well done.
Very much. And what fascinates me is you see the title, World's Greatest Dad, and you think, you know, wacky Disney family comedy, and then you see Robin Williams headlining the cast, you directing, and you come in with a certain expectation. And I was wondering, are you cognizant of that, setting these expectations up and then defying them?
No, I mean, I was being really snarky when I called it World's Greatest Dad because of the events that happen in it.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, I'm really, really hope that there's like a family of Mormons that, you know, go and get totally freaked out. I also like that, like, it's not a lot of guesswork. Like 5 minutes in, you know, there'll be a kid beating off with a belt. So it's not like, it won't be like, we were into the movie for half an hour and we were so disturbed, you know.
Yeah.
So, I will be happy if that happens.
But I'm curious where the seeds of this idea came from for you.
The ideas didn't really, you know, the events that happened in the movie didn't strike me as much as the end of the movie did. And it is weird to, you know, I was listening to Albert Brooks talk, and he was saying that the end of Lost in America came up, you know, came to him before the rest of the movie. And I was like, wow, that's really weird. But that is how this movie came up, you know, the speech Robin gives at the end. I wasn't even sure who his son would be or what his son would be like, but I just thought it'd be funny if that was the speech he gave.
Okay. And did you write this with Robin in mind?
No, I really... Because, you know, he plays a poetry teacher in this movie. So if I was writing a movie for Robin, I think he tackled that pretty well already. I wouldn't have made him a poetry
teacher. But it's a great parody of that in some way.
It is true. It is true. It is a parody. But I'm also glad that I got rid of the scene where he comes to school every day in an egg. but, no, yeah, it is really the, it is kind of the opposite of Dead Poets, of course, sure.
What strikes us both about this is obviously Robin Williams is one of our great actors, but he's really fantastic in this. And I was curious how you direct him.
Thanks. He really is. And so, like, even like a couple scenes in watching him act, I'm like going, oh man, you know, it's like suddenly I realized, you know, it was a huge, you know, I was like, wow, you know, he really is an amazing actor. You already said that, you know. So I did, I'll tell you, the night before we started filming, because I've known him for 25 years, and I'm like going, is he going to listen to me? You know what I mean? I really imagined him going, that's great, but that is one way we could do it, but I have an Academy Award and you were in Hot to Trot, so
right.
We're going to do it
my way.
There's
nothing wrong with
that. Yeah. But it was the direct opposite. You know, Robin and I would collaborate all the time, all day long, about who Lance is and what he would do and what he wouldn't do, which I think is, Robin said that it's the safest he's ever felt making a movie.
Okay.
Well, because my goal wasn't to, like, have him go crazy and then cut a performance into it. You know, he was involved in the whole process of everything, you know. It was really fun, like, even, like, you know, discussing things, like, as much as, like, his socks, you know. And he wasn't, like, going, why are we concerned about my socks, you know. And I'm like, well, you know, the ankles are the gateway into a man's soul, you know. He would just be, like, going... All right, yeah, he should have socks like that. So it was pretty funny.
That's good, though, that you mentioned that you just didn't want him to go crazy, because I think, like, after Mork and Mindy, everyone expected all of his movies to be, like, basically Mork. Like, and that's why people, I guess, were caught off guard by The World According to Garp, which I thought he was really good in. But, you know, people just wanted him to be Mork all the time. And I think it's great that you're giving him this, like, you know, really this range outside of everything that he's done before.
Well, thanks. I mean, it's been really cool. You know, making the movie was really cool, and now the fact that, you know, to hear you guys say that you liked it, it really does mean a lot to me. You know, I'm not that jaded. You know, I've been in comedy jail for about 20 years, so I'm really excited to see a lot of it. You know, your kind words, you're the file in the cake, you know, getting out of comedy jail. So
we appreciate this movie so much. I want to talk to you about moving from comedy to film in just a second. But you mentioned that Robin Williams felt very safe on this set and on this film, and this is not a film that was made with a safety net. It doesn't seem to be. So I'm curious, when you're dealing with a film this kind of delicate and tricky with the themes. What tone were you looking for, and when did you know that it was working?
Yeah, Well, the tone that I was working for is, you know, we just constantly go back to, you know, even though there's like characters that are to me kind of one dimensional and kind of cartoony, you know, the students and some of the other characters. You know, I'm kind of, and it sounds really pretentious, but I'm kind of always thinking of like Preston Sturges movies where there would be these like kind of, you know, outrageous characters, and that they were kind of, you know, but everything else, especially the leads, lots of times were playing things fairly straight, you know.
Right.
And that was kind of what we were going for. And there was these moments where, it's not even these moments where you know, like, I think he's really amazing on the talk show. When he's on the talk show and he gives this performance where, you know, I don't know what he's doing. And, you know, he said later on, he goes, it's pretty cool. I think I just had a breakdown. And I was like, well, that's really good. Can you do it again? And we just wiped his tears off and we did it again. But it's really tiny moments when I watched him act that I was like going, oh, this is a real person, you know. It was little stuff with his son, with Daryl. You know, he and Daryl would just kind of, you know, they would get into this thing where they really were those two people, where they were just always kind of winning, you know, just saying shitty little things. Oh, sorry. But, you know.
Say whatever you want.
Okay. But, you know, so they were always just, you know, that's when I was like, oh, this might work, you know, because they did seem like a real father and son sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Jerry and I were talking before you came on the line. One of the themes of the film that impressed us a lot was there's a lot of glorifying of the dead in this movie, and it seems like, especially in the past couple of months, our culture has been witnessing a lot of that. And I'm wondering, was that something you wanted to express particularly? It must have been.
Yeah, I mean, the way people reinvent or even, like, glom on the tragedies, you know what I mean? It's like you know, the disservice so many people did at 9/11, making it about them instead of people who really did lose people, which,
right.
You know, was disgusting. And then you know, it's just there's a little wink to the camera because, you know, that shot when he's in the porn stand and Robin starts crying, you know, that's Chris from Nirvana.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I go, well, you know how when someone passes away, people reinvent him, and then in the meantime, they kind of ignore the people that actually did know the person, and then make it all about themselves instead of about the people that cared about that person. I don't know if you can relate to that. And then Chris kind of. Yeah, so Chris just smiled at me, and he's like, kind of like, okay, I'm in.
Yeah, I mean, that's cool. That's who that was. That's great. I did, you know, it just seems like that part of the film, I mean, the whole thing is a scathing satire, but we whitewash these people, a lot of, like, bad people.
When you look at people's perception of Michael Jackson, it's like, I think because they're mourning the Michael Jackson from 85, you know? And I was like, you know, of course I feel bad for his daughter. And she's not his daughter, the girl he bought with someone else is a jizz, but when he's... When she says, oh, my dad is so great, you know, I'm like going, well, I'm sure he was really nice to you. You're a little girl, you know. I wanted to hear what the son had to say, but they didn't let him near the microphone. he got like, clotheslined by Tito Jackson before he could get to the mic.
Always a bad thing, or maybe a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that kid was blinking out Morse code behind his sister like a Vietnamese prisoner of war trying to send a Morse code home, like, make me go to Grandpa Joe's. So, yeah, I mean, as a culture, we just really, I don't know why we do that, and it's a very juvenile thing, too. Like, if you see the people that are doing, reinventing Michael Jackson, they're not fully developed adults. They're very infantile.
Yeah.
It's a teenage thing. So I guess it makes sense that we did take, you know, place in this movie in a school.
I'm afraid if, like, someone, like a horrible dictator or something died, they'd whitewash him, too. You know, they'd just say, oh, he was a great man.
Well, I mean, like, how old are you guys?
I'm 38, and...
Okay,
like,
well, you're old enough. I mean, like, this whole idea of, like, you know, the reinventing of Reagan, it's like,
oh,
really?
I remember
Reagan was a guy who didn't acknowledge AIDS, you know?
Yeah.
So now he's the, you know, Jesus Christ, you know? It's just, you know, whatever, so... History's not written history's written not by the winners, but by the smart enough friends of the winners.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
Absolutely right.
Don't want to get beat up anymore.
In terms of your move into filmmaking, obviously there was Shakes the Clown, but
right.
between that and Sleeping Dogs Lie, your last film, what happened in you? Because you seem to be very motivated to become a truly independent filmmaker.
Well, I am. That does motivate me. I really have no desire to make movies in the studio system because I don't really want to get notes from somebody about my brother, you know? It's like, mm-hmm. these people are based on all people I know, so you
right.
can't tell me how they would do anything. But, you know, I think, like, Shakes was a movie that I made, and it was, you know, none of it was supposed to be taken serious. Two things. I wish another actor played Shakes because I really wrote it with John Goodman in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish the other thing was that at the AA meeting, I wish he was Irishing up his coffee. Like, I wish he was pouring booze in the coffee while he's speaking at an AA meeting, you know. It's a day at a time, everyone. Gulp, gulp, gulp. But I think maybe people might have understood it a little more or whatever. I don't go, oh, no one got my masterpiece. But I really, you know, the Sleeping Dogs Lie and World's Greatest Dad was my attempt to see, hey, could I make a movie where people could actually identify with these characters, you know, and
yeah.
and they didn't have to I guess I'm going for empathy. I'm not really going for sympathy, and so this is what excites me. This isn't like, you know, lots of times like this is really what I'm happiest to be, you know, making movies, you know, and going to Sundance. I feel like a Starbelly Sneetch, and I finally found the other Starbelly Sneetches.
Yeah, watching your films, it's like, I mean, I hate to make comparisons, but it calls to mind a kind of compassionate Todd Solondz.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry and I were talking about Todd Solondz earlier.
Yeah, well, I think, like, you know what's funny is sometimes people will watch the movies I make and they're like, they're disappointed in the end because they'll say that they're cop-out because he gives a happy end. But I almost feel that it's almost more subversive to try to write a happy ending.
Yeah.
But I also think it's funny as if, like, it's as if, like, at the end of World's Greatest Dad, I had 5 minutes left and I said, oh, I better make this commercial. You know, I know people have seen Robin Williams' Hog and a kid died, but I better try to cue it up in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, but no, it was good the way. I thought the ending was perfect, and I mean, you're right. It is in this day and age. It is the subversive thing to go for the happy ending, or I guess the bittersweet maybe, or ending.
And it made perfect sense to that
you
journey.
Know? Well, thanks. And that's the thing. It's like when I'm making these screenplays and stuff. You know, and it's not. And by the way, all the screenplays that I write, they don't all end that way. You know, I'm finishing up a movie where it is kind of like, you know, what have we become and who are we? You know, kind of an ending. But
mm-hmm.
you know, I just want to. I know every once in a while I sound like Dirk Diggler to me. I just want to keep making movies. I'm just going to keep rocking and rolling. A few people, you know. But I am sincere. You know, I really love making movies, and I just hope I can keep making them. And I don't want to make them on other people's terms, and I just want
right.
to work with people I respect and like.
We want to see everything you do,
yeah,
man. And
we really do.
Before we let you go, let me ask you about your upcoming projects. You talked about writing, I believe, like a serial killer project and a Kinks musical. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
It's a spree killer movie, and and that's the one I've been almost finished on. The problem is I finished it and it was 167 pages, so I'm trying to get it down to 120 pages. And that's kind of an indictment on us. It's more about our culture than about the actual killers. And it wasn't about, you know, I know that like Natural Born Killers is really a parody of the media, but I kind of just wanted a parody like who we've become as people. And then the other thing is the Kinks thing is Schoolboys in Disgrace, which is an album of the Kinks from the 70s, which I you know, I've loved the Kinks. So I met with Ray, and he kind of gave me the blessing to write a screenplay for it. So that's where it's at. It's not like there's a studio involved or any of this kind of stuff. But he was like, well, who do you think would, you know, go to this movie? By the way, I was sweating, like, when I was talking to him. It was like the Chris Farley show, you know. He goes, who's this movie for? And I said, well, all the kids that fucking hate High School Musical. And then he goes, oh, okay. And he smiled. And so that's the two things that I'm working on. But I've got to wrap it up. I'm really sorry. It's been great talking to you.
Understand.
You too. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, guys. Thanks a lot.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, Bobcat Goldthwait. The movie is World's Greatest Dad. It opens in select theaters on Friday, and it's currently available on your video on demand systems.
So go watch it right now. Well, after our show, go watch it. But yeah.
Yeah. And then put Jason's Oscar show on in the background. It's a great movie. So, and then we're coming out in full support of it.
We
here
are.
On the show.
We really are, because it will really, like I said, it will really surprise you.
Yeah. Hang on, knows we need more movies that do that.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, so we're going to move on from Bobcat Goldthwait to advertising. This is a fascinating film. It's been making the rounds at film festivals, and it comes out just like World's Greatest Dad. It comes out in select theaters on Friday.
Okay.
It's a movie called Art and Copy. It's about the advertising world and the artists who work in it. And it was a real eye-opener for me when I watched it because, as he expresses in this interview, you think advertising, commercials and print and all that kind of stuff, and you kind of think, you know, what artists would work in that medium? It seems like a sellout medium because you're so used to seeing such crap.
Well, that I'm going to counter that right now. My brother's worked in that industry for, God, like 20, 22 years, and he went from, you know, the film industry to that, and it's like a really, you know, it's a different kind of storytelling, as he puts it, but it is storytelling, just a different kind, and it's, I mean, advertising's sort of in right now because of the Mad Men, and but that's a whole different era of advertising that doesn't exist anymore.
But you think about the global ramifications of some of these campaigns.
Oh yeah,
and you think that there are a few, well, more than a few. There are artists that work in that industry, and it's just kind of luck of the draw. When they hit the zeitgeist, you know, and something clicks, how would anyone know that Gut Milk would click? How would anyone know that Just Do It would click?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But
I mean,
those slogans are known throughout the globe.
Right. Yeah.
They caught on.
You're absolutely right.
And I guess that's where the artistry comes in, and it's about expressing something, not beyond just selling a product. I think the most successful campaigns do that.
Yeah.
And so this is a fascinating conversation with the director of the film, Doug Prey, who a lot of his previous movies, he's explored creatives and their kind of offbeat ways of expressing themselves. So here's Doug.
The frightening and most difficult thing about being what somebody calls a creative person is that you have absolutely no idea where any of your thoughts come from, really. And especially if you don't have any idea about where they're going to come from tomorrow.
Absolutely do not. Put that commercial in the air.
This is the devil's workshop.
Get that f***ing commercial off the air.
People went crazy.
Did you see that thing?
Oh, by the way, I'm taking it.
This goes on and on and on and on.
I'm getting thousands of phone calls.
I want five.
I got you. I got you by the balls.
That's advertising, baby.
I always thought that advertising was the most whorish business a person could get into.
Advertising makes food taste better. It makes cars run better. It changes the perception of everything.
What you can do is manufacture any feeling you want to manufacture.
I think many times what they're buying is what they wish their lives would be.
I guess I understand why people trash advertising, because a lot of advertising is trash. You can do so much more.
There are a lot of people in this business, but damn few really good ones.
Creative people rise up. They can't do shit unless we make ads for them. We should be in charge.
I hated the system. I hated the status quo.
Advertising should be statements about what the hell you think your life should be about.
All they cared about is milking money out of clients. How big do you want the logo, sir?
You can be more than just a car company. More than just a pet food company.
You can speak honestly and use this profession to do that. Weird can happen.
I think creativity can solve anything.
I can get excited about selling a new kind of pen. Wow, what? Look at that pen. Yeah, it's a little distance. It's a little, there's this. Wow, that's sensitive. Let me sell that motherfucker.
fascinated me, and the first thing that fascinated me about it, and the fact that you made it, is because your films have centered around creative artists and their means of expression in the past. And I'm wondering how you saw advertising fitting into that, and what inspired you to follow that as the subject of this film.
Well, at first I thought it was really different. I thought it was so different. I do work in advertising, but even that is a little bit disconnected from this, my work in this actual movie. But I always looked at advertising as commerce. Like that's just what people do. It's always happened. It's always going to happen. And there it is. And you don't analyze it too deeply. You know, it just is.
Right. Right.
And as opposed to a lot of my other movies, which are documenting people who are, you know, just either underground or struggling artists or just doing really compelling, interesting things that are very different from the norm, very non-mainstream work. And so I kind of thought, wow, when I got involved in this film, that this is a real departure. But the more I got involved in it, the more I thought it was almost as I was completing Art and Copy, I kind of stood back from it and I said, you know, despite the differences, like the fact that it's, you know, these people work in the mainstream, they're paid very well, they're kind of, you know, captains of industry, if you will, they're actually doing the same thing. Mm. They're still mavericks. They actually had to really fight to get their messages through. And their battle, in a lot of ways, is almost bigger because they are working inside the system and because they had to be pushing some crazy product and there was 50 clients that they had to please and there was a committee and market research and all this stuff. And yet despite all that, at least the people in this particular film and some of these campaigns, they still managed to do something that was really inspiring or really human or really funny or whatever, but that touched people or actually kind of changed our culture in a way that isn't necessarily bad.
Right.
You know? It was like good or like really uplifting, maybe.
Well, it's obvious that advertising is highly influential and it reaches a lot of people. I'm curious, was there a particular campaign or a period of time when advertising became recognized as a possible art form?
Well, I think it always had been, but my movie Art and Copy really kind of begins in the 1960s with the DDB, Doyle Dane Birnbach, so what they call the Creative Revolution. And I think that the first campaigns that they did perfectly summarized the entire argument for creative advertising. And so, again, it's not that it hadn't been done before, but what they did that was so groundbreaking was that they brought in the ability to make social statements.
Right.
And they brought in – the reason the movie is named Art and Copy is really simply that it was the first time artists had ever been put in the room with copywriters. It used to be this really disconnected thing. It was like, okay, here's the copy. All right, give it to the artist. Artist just put some art on it, and boom, it just goes out. And it led to all those kind of like atrocious advertising, you know, the mid-early part of that century where it's like, you know, big car ads and all this information. And so all of a sudden in 1959, Bill Birnbach and the people working with him come up with this ad that's like basically a white page with a tiny little VW in the middle, and it says, think small.
Yeah.
And it's completely radical, just totally radical because it went against every single trend there was in advertising and in cars, and it also completely matched the sort of, you know, what was about to happen in the entire country, which was this huge revolt against thinking big.
Right.
And I think it just sums it up perfectly, and I think some of the best advertising and a lot of the ads in Art and Copy, they are like that. They actually reflect kind of a revolutionary sentiment, or they reflect the way people are thinking about life at that time, and they just kind of hit on some, you know, on a very large level, some kind of general thought pattern in the nation. And it's really interesting. It really is sociology.
It's a fascinating world. And actually, those Volkswagen ads are beautiful. I love those ads. Is simplicity kind of the king, to be as simplistic and efficient as possible with your message? Because I'm thinking about Got Milk and Just Do It, which you, of course, cover in your film. And somehow those hit a nerve, just the simplicity of it.
I think simplicity is a major factor. And I would say that's true of all filmmaking. Because when I'm doing interviews on any subject, I'm always looking for the simplest answer. And the best quotes are always the ones that are just really, really simple. And so when it comes to advertising, there's Jeff Goodby says in the film, he says something like, great advertising is like haiku. You have 30 seconds, or you have just a single print ad, and you have to communicate a lot of different things in just a few words. And it's actually an enormous challenge, and one in the chances I've had there, I do direct advertising at times, and what I do is documentary style commercials sometimes. But it really is an enormous challenge to try to say, wait a minute, we only have I have to tell this whole story in 7 shots and get a perfect quote that lasts no longer than 12 seconds.
Yeah.
And yet they're like real people. They're not actors. Like, it's a documentary thing. There's nothing, you know, we can't completely control everything. So it's actually really fascinating. I've actually enjoyed that challenge because it's made me a better director. It's forced me to figure out, how do you get better quotes?
Yeah. You know, that's absolutely a question that I wanted to ask, because I remember reading accounts of somebody like Stanley Kubrick, and he loved watching commercials. He said, this is the best filmmaking that's happening right now. And then you look at people like Ridley Scott and Michael Bay that started in the advertising world. How is that a good training ground, do you think?
Well, it's good for that reason we've already said, that it forces you to be completely efficient, which is just pure great writing. I know I was at a film festival recently, and a screenwriter said that he plays this game of, like, when people enter the room and they're going to do dialogue, like if he has a whole page of dialogue, he plays this game of trying to get it. They can only say 5 words to communicate everything that has to go on in the whole scene. And I was like, man, that's just like advertising.
Yeah.
But what it does also is, if you do work in advertising, it was actually quite terrifying at first to work in it, because as an independent, very much a do-it-yourself kind of filmmaker, I mean, I really had been that forever, it was really strange and very challenging to suddenly have people in your ear saying, no, it needs to be like this. You know, or like, no, it should be purple, not red. Or like, you know, like you're trying to direct and you're making decisions, which is what directors do. And then you realize, wait a minute, I'm serving like a client, an agency, a creative team, a producer, another producer. You know, you have all these people kind of around you. So what it does is, if you can put up with that and kind of learn to live with it, it teaches you how to be highly collaborative, because you're not going to get there otherwise.
Right.
Unless you're one of those rare directors who's just a complete jerk and totally brilliant. And I know that happens sometimes.
There are
a few out
there.
I have a really hard time with that. I have a really hard time with both parts of that.
Another aspect of advertising, the political advertisement. And obviously during the campaign we saw a lot of that. I think we're seeing a lot of that with the healthcare push. It really does have global kind of political implications, and that's a lot of power.
It is. I mean, the one political advertisement in the movie is the what's called the Good Morning America campaign by Hal Reiney for Ronald Reagan, which, when I think back on those days, you don't even want to hear my opinions about the whole thing. But it was really effective advertising because it was so emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's one of the best political ads, again, regardless of what you think politically, it's one of the best political ads because it completely deals on a human level.
Right.
It's like, it's sort of talking about issues and this and that and the economy and stuff, but, you know, it's like you don't really get that from the ad. You just watch and you go, oh, wow, you know. And I think that a lot of ads have just repeated that, even the Obama ads. In fact, it was quite interesting that my editor, Philip Owens, who's a brilliant editor, he actually had to leave our post-production process for about a month to go back to New York to edit the Obama half-hour show that came out before the election.
Yeah.
And it was so interesting because he had just left our editing room where we were still dealing with the Riney quotes and the Reagan ad and all this stuff. We were sort of like fresh on his mind with the whole good, you know, Morning in America campaign. And there he was like doing the exact same things, like, you know, just like slow motion shots of children and the sunlight coming in. And it's like, you know,
it hits those trigger points.
Is
yeah.
Propaganda. It just is.
Right.
Just plain and simple, and I think it can be used very powerfully, and I think it can be dangerous, and I think all of those thoughts. But it can also be beautiful, and it can be, if it's saying something quite human, then, you know.
And also that Lyndon Johnson ad that shows up in your film. That's one of the ballsiest ads I've ever seen. It's highly effective.
It was so outrageous when it came out that apparently, and I'm not a I don't know the whole story in this. I'm learning it from various people who see the movie or telling me, but it was pulled. They just couldn't. They couldn't. It was a total outrage.
It's too intense. Yeah.
I mean, it was basically saying, vote for Lyndon Johnson or the entire world's going to blow up.
Right. But there is a cautionary side to this, as you've spoken to, and I'm wondering these artists that you've spoken to in relation to this film, they are very much aware of that.
Well, they're aware of the power.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is when I asked, you know, when I asked all of these individuals about, you know, what do you really think about advertising? Are you embarrassed that you do ads? Do you hate advertising sometimes? Do you wish you were in another field? Or all of them feel pretty strongly that most advertising sucks.
Mm-hmm.
They really do believe that. And I mean, Lee Clow goes on and on about how, you know, 95% of all advertising is really pretty lame.
Yeah.
And they have reasons why it is. It's because they gave into committee think, or they listened too hard to market research, or they had bad clients, or they just didn't have the opportunity, or, you know, a million reasons why it's hard to make good advertising. But I guess it's just in the end, when it comes down to it, the really good advertising is surprisingly honest. It doesn't really bother us. I say us just in general. It really doesn't offend people. It actually can be really inspiring, like I've said, you know, at the beginning. In other words, when advertising is lowest common denominator and it treats us poorly and it kind of talks down to us and just throws a bunch of information at us that might be really boring or kind of annoying, or if it makes us feel bad in a bad way, then there's no point. I mean, I'm pretty sure all the people in my film feel that that's just plain bad advertising.
Right.
And unfortunately, there's just a lot of it out there, and it's the sad thing is that what it does is it makes a lot of people who are really smart and creative and have a lot to say and have, you know, interesting political voices, it makes them immediately say, well, advertising's not for me. I'm not going to work in advertising.
Uh-huh.
Whereas I wish the opposite were true. I wish it was like what George Lois said back in the 60s, which is like, man, everybody wanted to work in advertising at one point. Because it was a place where you could actually put your politics into these ads. And, yeah, it's for a product, and, yeah, you're selling something, but did you hear that? Sorry, there was some interference. There was some bad interference. I don't know why. I'm sorry.
That's
but,
okay.
But like George Lois was just saying how, you know, but it's a place where you can actually really make a difference and you can actually get your messages across. And
yeah.
Ads can be political and they can be revolutionary if you want.
Uh-huh.
And I think uh-huh. that opportunity is lost on a lot of people. It certainly was lost on me for, you know, most of my career. I never, ever would have thought of ads in that way.
Well, and neither did I, but this film is really fascinating, and it gave me a whole new appreciation of that world, and so that's what I appreciated most about it. Okay, director Doug Prey, the movie is Art and Copy, out in theaters this Friday. Be on the lookout for it. It's a great
talk. Okay, no, it sounds fascinating. I mean, it is a fascinating subject, but I like the honesty when he's talking about it, because there's a lot of truth in what he's saying about
there's a lot of truth in advertising.
Yeah, there is, but I mean, it is a lot of it. I mean, my brother would say a lot of it you could just throw down the garbage disposal.
Yeah.
But you get to work with some pretty cool people. I mean, you get to work with a lot of actors and things like that, so.
Yeah. You're going to check out, well, we are, all are.
Yeah, I think we're all going to check it out.
Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
This weekend.
Yeah, we're all. That's the thing to see. I mean, unless we're all going to see shorts. I mean, if that's as my good friend Paul Busetti said a couple of weeks ago, why would you make shorts just because your son wrote it, or you wanted to make it for your son? Why would you make shorts?
I don't even wear them.
especially while he's on the air, folks.
Actually, there's something that Time Out did. Let's see if you agree with this. They listed the five moments that made Quentin Tarantino.
Okay.
One of them is the scene, the stuck in the middle with you ear cutting scene in Reservoir Dogs.
That I'll definitely go with.
The other?
Well, there's four more.
The others. Sorry.
The others. Yes.
Oh, man, my computer, my slow-loading computer.
Okay.
What do you think some of the others are?
Well, I'll tell you what I think they should be. I think the scene, see, they're all, some of them are subdued. I think the scene where Beatrix Kiddo explains to Hattori Hanzo about the big rat that she needs to kill. And he writes in the fog, the steam in the glass, Bill, you know, and you got that Zamfara music playing in the background. I think that's a beautiful scene. I think the scene where Uma Thurman, yeah, they all revolve around Uma, where they have to revive her in Pulp Fiction.
Right.
It's definitely one of those chaotic scenes. But
their choice from Pulp Fiction, and by the way, I don't agree with the headline of this, the five moments that made Quentin Tarantino. I think Quentin Tarantino was made in one moment with Reservoir Dogs. And
yeah, I agree with
that
100%. Good
that
point.
Moment they listed. Pulp Fiction scene, they choose the Jackrabbit Slim's dance.
See, that's too... Okay, yeah, all right, go forward, go.
True Romance, as a screenwriter, they choose the walk-in Dennis Hopper scene.
That's a great scene. I thought they meant the things that he directed, though. I would go with that, though. That's an awesome scene. That is a great scene.
Jackie Brown, they have a flirty exchange between Pam Grier and Robert Forrester.
Well, that's... Well, I would put the whole movie, but that's just me. These are what they're... Okay, go on.
And the last one is from Kill Bill... The fight, volume one, the fight at the end. And
that's a great fight and everything, even though it's like a combination of Lady Snowblood and Sex and Fury. And I mean, that's where it's lifted from, but I don't know if they any... I like these... I think Kill Bill, it's really these funny scenes in it, especially in the second part, where Michael Madsen confronts... Larry Bishop, Larry Gomez in the strip club, and he gives that whole little speech to him, and he's just, like, ragging on him while doing these lines of blow with the other stripper, and that's a funny scene. And it's just, like, great moments like that. I don't know, can you really narrow down the five moments? I like what Roger Ebert said about Tarantino in that book, The Big Book of Film, or that came out, I think, in 96. He just said, this guy, when he arrived, and there's no stopping him.
Yeah.
I mean, like what you said with Reservoir Dogs, when that movie comes on the scene, I mean, yeah, there are, you can obviously see all the movies influenced by, but he did it, he repackaged it, and he gave his own slant.
Well, that is the truth of most everything he's ever done.
Yeah, but he gives it his own slant. I mean, I think it was either David Edelstein or A.O. Scott in a review of Kill Bill Volume 2 that said he is like a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes all these things that he's watched and he creates his own mix.
Right.
And I think that's a fair and analogy of what he does. And I think every time, look, even Death Proof, which a lot of people don't like, if that's his bad film, that's better than 95% of everyone's better films. Okay,
mm-hmm.
If that's an off day for Tarantino, God, I hope my off days are like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, what this guy's done since 1992, I think, is just outstanding work. And I'm sure we're going to get that on Friday.
It's funny, because Tarantino's never one to be speechless.
mm-hmm.
And,
never.
Sometimes
to his disadvantage, I think. But
yeah, but he was last night. I watched I have Howard Stern on demand, so I watch his the filmed radio shows, and he was on Howard Stern. And
How was that? What did he say? Because I heard about that in your comments from that show. What was that like? What happened?
Oh, it was fine. It was great. I mean, it wasn't a film centric interview because Howard Stern's not.
No, that's what's great about Howard Stern, though.
But he clammed up. I mean, Tarantino said, I will not talk about that many, many times, particularly about, you know, certain liaisons with Uma Thurman, that kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a revealing kind of interview. So that was good. There's a couple of movie news things to cover.
Yeah, let's go, man. Let's do it.
First of all, Sunday we had to push back our casino tribute that it will take place this Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern.
Yay!
And it'll feature a great 30-minute conversation with Frank Vincent,
mm-hmm.
and clips and analysis, the movie geek style analysis on
my
casino.
Homage, Don Rickles.
Yes. Yeah, we'll have
all right,
a
not
whole.
Not really, Hamid. I'll just say, yeah, it was great to see him.
We'll have a whole segment in there about Don Rickles.
Thank you.
But we should replay the argument about Landau and Rickles.
You should. You really should. No, that would be perfect.
I gotta locate that that argument.
Okay.
I gotta remember what show that was. So that'll be Sunday, and then we'll give you, or I'll give you my full report on the Avatar footage next Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Screen's
oh, cool.
Right.
Good.
But movie news that I thought was interesting, for those that care,
care.
Stallone's new movie, The Expendables,
yes.
has a great cast. And by great, I mean Dolph Lundgren's in it.
And we interviewed him.
Yes.
For you interviewed him. But he's been on our show. But we got
Eric Roberts is in it.
Mm-hmm. Mickey Rourke.
Heroic, yeah. How could we forget that? And I guess the big news that just came out today, Schwarzenegger's in it, and Bruce Willis is in it.
Yeah.
And so for the first time, the three action icons, Stallone, Schwarzenegger, and Willis, will share the screen.
That's reason enough to celebrate. This is gonna be a wild movie. It'll be very nostalgic for us.
My guess is that Bruce Willis will play the translator.
It's already looking better than Surrogates. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah,
that's horrible. That might be a very good movie. Just the trailer didn't do anything for me, but
yeah. So that's exciting. If you enjoy that sort of thing.
It is. Because I think Stallone's on to something here, because I think he realizes with his last Rambo movie, and even with some of these, they're not great. Don't get me wrong. These you know, a lot of these wrestlers trying to make it in the action movies and everything.
Right.
I think he realizes, hey, we all used to do this better than you guys, and let's try one more time. And I guess he has a nostalgia. There's a certain nostalgia for this kind of movie.
Yeah.
And I think it has a lot of potential.
There's also talk of a Hancock sequel.
Yeah, now what's up with that? What exactly where could you go with that?
Well, Peter Berg wants to do it. He says there might be another one. Picking up where it left off.
Right. Okay. He's doing a big screen version of Dune. They're going to try to do Dune
right,
again.
Right. Do you think that's a good idea? And do you think Peter Berg's bright for it?
I don't think Dune is, and this is the thing, if Lynch couldn't really, and I think Dune has some great moments in it, but Dune is really a psychological, like a really in the mind, it's really stuff that's really in the mind. A lot of, it works better on page than it does in film.
Right.
I think, and I just think, I don't think anyone's going to be able to, I know that that supposedly this TV miniseries they made on Sci-Fi a couple years ago was supposed to be good or closer to the book, but I think it's one of those things that probably doesn't translate well to the screen. That's just me.
Yeah, it could just be one of those mountains that you can't climb successfully.
You know, if someone tries now, let me tell you this. If someone tries, if David Lynch said, I'm going to try to make Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow into a movie, I'd be like, okay, if you can do that, you can do anything. But, yeah, it's one of those books that's just very hard to, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, I know this thing is, oh, we have the technology to do it. That argument doesn't work with me.
Because
it's not, movies aren't, the technology is a, it should help tell the story, but it shouldn't be the thing that is the story.
It shouldn't be the story, yeah.
Yeah,
I agree with you. And it kinda, I do yearn to see Lynch do something intelligible again.
I think Inland Empire has its moments, but it is a hard movie. It is a hard movie to get into. It's not the kind of thing I'm rushing to watch again, even though I have it on DVD.
I mean, I said intelligible. And that's one thing you can't blame Inland Empire for being.
Yeah.
I can't understand the damn thing. But even so, I can't understand all of Fire Walk With Me, but I get its vibe, you know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm with the movie.
Right.
And then probably in terms of narrative, while maintaining his authentic kind of unique voice at the same time, probably Blue Velvet is his tops.
Mm-hmm. I would think Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart.
Well, Blue Velvet is very structured.
Yeah.
And yet it still maintains all the oddity that comes with a Lynch film. You know?
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
I'd love to see him return to form along those lines.
I'd love to see something like that again from him. I really would. I just like to see something from him, even though it's only been like 2 or 3 years since Inland Empire. I just like to see him working, I guess.
Did you check out that documentary on him, the Lynch one?
Not that one. I've seen the other one, Pretty as a Picture. I haven't seen
right.
the Lynch one yet, because that just came out in DVD within the last year, right?
Yes.
Okay, I have it on a Netflix queue, or I have it on, actually, I don't even think Netflix, I have it on the on-demand, like, you can download it. So I want to check that out. I really do.
I submitted an interview request, I mean, when this was screening at Cannes, this documentary,
because
it follows him as he's shooting Inland Empire. And so I sent an interview request to the director, whose name is Black.
That's the name?
That's his name.
Okay.
And he even signed the email Black.
All right. Hey, more power.
Yeah. So I sent him a request, but we were never able to get it together. Another piece of interesting movie news this week, it's more of a rumor. I don't know the truth of it, but they're revitalizing Lestat, which first of all makes
sense.
There's
a lot of controversy about this already.
Well, it makes sense because I'm sure they're thinking, hey, Twilight, vampires are in again.
True blood, everything, yeah.
Especially, yeah. So they're wanting an adult kind of treatment of this, so they go back to Anne Rice's books. I don't know if it's a remake or another book that she read. I never read those books. But,
I read the first five.
You read the first five?
I read the first five, but I stopped.
You slacker. You only read the first five?
dude, I got bored with them. This was in, I stopped with in 95. Because I had read them, you know, I read the interview, Lestat, the Vampire Lestat, which I guess is the one they want to make, the second one.
Yeah, well, by all accounts, Anne Rice should have stopped in 95, too. But
she keeps going, bitch. She just keeps going.
Interesting. It is interesting how, if you recall, Tom Cruise's casting in that film was met with tremendous controversy.
Oh, yeah.
And now the rumor is that Robert Downey Jr. is taking over the role of Lestat for the new incarnation of that series. And that's generating some controversy as well?
Yeah, it has. People say he's too old to play the part.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing I've been hearing. I think it's a very good choice. And let me tell you, while Interview with a Vampire is not a perfect movie, it is actually much better than anyone, I think, was willing to give it credit. I thought Cruise was wonderful with Lestat.
I didn't have a problem with Cruise in it. I don't have a problem with Cruise in general, but I think he's been very good in some movies. I don't think that's one of them.
It's a decent movie.
I don't think he embarrasses himself. The thing that strikes me most about Interview with the Vampire is the cinematography. That's when I, in my mind's eye, when I think of that movie, I see those gorgeous shots.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's gorgeous. Gorgeous looking movie.
Oh, it is. It is. I think Robert Downey Jr. is a very interesting choice. I was kind of surprised that there's this backlash already against that, but I think he could pull it off.
I don't understand the backlash anyway. Our next guest, we're going to bring on a good friend of the show. He's waiting on the line, but I just want to say I don't understand people so up in arms that they throw a backlash against stuff like that. But
look, Anne Rice made such a fool out of herself with that.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so I just think everyone should just learn from that and just be like, just chill out.
Yeah, but at the same time, I can almost understand Anne Rice because she created the characters. She lived for years with the characters.
Right.
But I guess I'm just being too cynical. In the long run, it's probably a very good thing that there are people out there that feel so passionately about creative works of art that that they can generate that kind of outrage over the casting of Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
That's my pained attempt at optimism right there.
There you go. There you go. That's what we love about you.
Yeah. Last year, one of my favorite movies was Captain Abu Rad. It was a foreign film, beautiful fable, Capra-esque type fable. One of the best films I saw last year. And we welcomed on the director of that film, and we also welcomed on the composer, because it's a gorgeous score for that movie. And I'm in contact with the composer, Mr. Austin Wintory, off and on. And he told me that the soundtrack will be available for pre-sale soon, possibly today. We'll confirm that with him because he's on the line now. And we're very happy to bring him back on for a little conversation. Austin, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes,
I can hear you, buddy.
Well, how are you guys doing?
We're doing good. How are you?
If I may weigh in on the Interview with the Vampire discussion,
please.
Definitely one of the better scores of the 90s, like top 15, 10 maybe even. It's a pretty brilliant score.
Yeah.
If that's my only contribution to your conversation.
No, that's a good point.
That is a very good point. And I recall that score, Elliot Goldenthal, and my understanding was they fired the original composer.
Yep.
Who was
George Fenton?
George Fenton, and
exactly.
Left Goldenthal with just weeks to complete that.
Oh, more like one. I mean, it was something like 9 days.
Wow.
And there's a tiny bit of George Fenton's score that stayed in the movie, but generally speaking, it's entirely Goldenthal. I mean, you know, he had done a few big films before that, but that was the one that made the entire Hollywood community say, holy shit. And he got Oscar nominated for 9 days' work. So
right, yeah.
Way to go.
That's some great work. And I guess there's some benefit of being under the gun. Maybe it brings something out of you that wouldn't be there if you labored over it forever. I think
it's been the case for me. I mean, Captain Abu Rad was pretty much like that. I mean, not that to that extreme, but it was three weeks, so it was it was definitely, you know, one of those where you don't have any time to second guess yourself, and And, you know, that said, there's half a dozen things in the score that I'm like, it would be so great if I could just change that little thing, that thing. So,
right.
It's no Interview with a Vampire, but it's okay.
Oh, it's a gorgeous score, and it works perfectly for the movie, which is the important thing. But I bring up the whole writing under the gun thing because I'm looking at your credits right now. I'm investigating you. And you have, in 2009, if this is to be believed, 17 films that you composed for?
Well, you know, IMDb
when
is a little
sleep?
Deceptive. I am right now, actually. First off, IMDb is a little deceptive, especially if you're not looking at the IMDb Pro, because some of those are short films, and you only find that out by clicking on it, and it tells you, you know, because some of those are like 7-minute films, you know, that are little kind of projects here and there with friends of mine and stuff like that.
Right. Okay.
So that right off the bat takes care of a big chunk of those. And also, the way IMDb is, some of those projects I did a long time ago. Because depending on when a film finally gets released, like Captain Alborad is a good example of that, where, you know, the film is in theaters right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote that score almost 2 years ago. So,
right.
You know, it's IMDb can be very, very deceptive. Like, if you look on there, the very oldest score I have is some random short that I did called Arjuna, which is definitely, like, that's like the year it credits at, is it as is before I ever moved to L.A. So I have no idea.
Yeah.
I moved to L.A. in 2005. So I don't.
You wrote that one on the plane to L.A., right?
That's right. Actually, you know, that's... Very good point.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, you know, it has been a good year. I have been very lucky. I'm working on my fifth and sixth features for this year. So I have,
wow.
I've done 4 films so far this year. Last year was my banner year. I had 9 last year as far as feature films.
So that was your Jude Law year.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk about one of these films that we didn't get a chance to talk much about last time you were on, and that's the film Grace.
Yeah, sure.
People are crazy about this film. Tell me about that project and the particular challenges of bringing that to life.
I wrote it last summer, so it's now a year ago, and
right.
it was and remains and probably will always remain one of the most sort of creatively satisfying things I've ever done. It was an odd... The whole thing is kind of strange because part of it was the most ideal circumstance you could ever imagine working under, and part of it was the most hellacious thing you could ever dream up. You know, there were certain... I don't really want to get into the negative details, but needless to say, there were certain kind of political things involved in that film that were a nightmare. At the same time, the director, it was just me and the director. I never had, you know, you hear these horror stories of the studio guys or producers looking over your shoulder and you know, how many horror stories are there with extreme examples like Gabriel Yared's Troy, where people come in and make executive decisions involving the music who have, like, probably never even heard it.
Right.
And that film could have been a situation like that, and it wasn't at all. So in that way, it was the most ideal kind of little private laboratory where the director and I got to experiment and to try things that were really out there and really push our personal envelopes. You know, I don't know whether we did anything that had truly never been done before. I mean, you know, who can be the judge of that on their own thing? But I can say that I had certainly done nothing like that before, and neither had he. And so it also was kind of ideal in that he and I were friends for years before that, and I had read all the drafts of the script as he was writing and rewriting and pitching it to various production companies. And so more so than with any other film that I've ever done, I kind of got to see that thing through. I got to visit the set and, you know, get to know the actors and even kind of work with them. We wrote music to play back on set to sort of so that my – because I knew the script better than any of the actors because, you know, they had been hired within the months, you know, leading up to production. Whereas I had read it and reread it for 3 years.
Right.
And
okay. So,
you know, that I was like, let's find a way to use that, you know? So I wrote all this music based on the script that was intentionally meant for playback on set to kind of help the actors sort of gain a certain, a very specific kind of perspective of their character. And
right.
It was sort of an interesting experiment, you know?
Yeah,
how
is that? Writing with the actor there. I mean, you're writing it. How does that? Are these like motifs you're writing for them? Like their individual themes?
It was I wrote a 20-minute score that was a series of the director and I spotted the script the way you would spot a film, where
mm-hmm.
we went through and said, what are the scenes that we think would benefit from this? And then I went and wrote music that was not. Like, it wasn't an imaginary score for the scene. In other words, it was not ever music that was meant to be even remotely translatable into the scene,
mm-hmm.
because it was meant to be entirely within the character's perspective, such
mm-hmm.
that a scene that the director wanted to be quiet and subtle, wherein a character is having a nervous breakdown, I wrote a viciously gigantic dissonant cue that's kind of like, what's going on the inside? And
right, okay.
So, you know, we could, while their actors getting their makeup on, you know, we give it to them in headphones on an iPod, and they sit there and listen, and the idea was to basically drive them a little bit insane and then put them in front of the camera, and then, you know, just, you know, my fantasy for it was their eyes alone would have all that kind of energy wrapped into it that when we go to actually score the film, we don't actually end up scoring that scene because it's so emotionally potent and powerful that score would push it over the top and ruin it. And so the idea was almost like writing music to avoid writing music.
That's a fascinating.
To see if it would even work.
It is.
That's a fascinating technique.
Yeah.
And because I would think it would be so valuable for the actor, because I read things like actors using certain music to prepare themselves, as you've been discussing. And I remember reading that for Gangs of New York, Daniel Day-Lewis used to sit in his trailer and listen to Eminem to get him
yeah.
at the very.
Well, that would be the thing to do it for Bill the Butcher. Yeah,
I mean, which I think is just a hysterical image of him listening to Eminem in that in that getup.
Yeah.
But
right.
that's a fascinating experiment,
mm-hmm.
and you have to have a director free enough to allow that kind of.
Oh yeah, I mean he was like that on all fronts. You know, another kind of recurring nightmare that you hear composers talk about is the idea of a director who falls in love with his temp track.
Yes.
And in this case, Paul said, look, I don't even want to go down that. I don't even want a temp. In fact, when it came time for, you know, studio executives, sales agents, and all the people to see the movie, you know, the director said, look, we need to show this movie in the best possible light. And since there's no temp, he said, basically, will you just make a temp that we can show for that? And it won't have anything to do with what you and I are doing. But we need to have a temp just so that when we show people cuts of the movie, it's not so bare bones. Because it obviously needed a score. And you know, when you're trying to show a sales agent, it's hard to make a good impression when you're like, now just use your imagination and imagine score.
Right.
And so I got to make the entire temp, and it had no bearing on the score at all. It had nothing, you know, I temped it with like Basic Instinct and all these big orchestral. I used some of Hans's The Ring,
mm-hmm.
and my score is nothing like those. It's not orchestral. It's really kind of its own beast. That because we got, you know, we had 3 months to sit there and experiment, but the temp was something I just cranked out in a day and sent it to them, and they were able to, you know, use it to send to film festivals and things, and. And then meanwhile, we got to do the score. And again, it's like very amazingly lucky that not only did we not have to deal with a director loving the temp, but he didn't even want to do a temp. He said, it's just going to be a waste of time.
Yeah.
And, I mean,
I know,
you know, it was crazy.
This is a tricky proposition, I'm sure. But beyond the images that you see on the film that you're working on, say something like Captain Abu-Rad,
mm-hmm.
which is, in its structure, a fable of sorts.
Oh, absolutely.
Beyond watching the film and coming up with your ideas from that avenue, do you get inspiration from other composers' works at all?
No, I'm really the only good one. It's a lone existence.
I asked that because, of course, the danger is that you end up not getting that other composer's score out of your head, and you have to resist the urge to copy that. But actors build a performance the same way.
Yeah, and I think it's similar. I mean, of course, there's a million. I mean, for me, as we talked about last time, Goldsmith is my god, you know.
By the way,
did you guys go buy? It was like days after we got off the phone that they announced the big deluxe 2-disc Boys from Brazil. Please tell me you went and bought it.
No. I thought I was under the impression I was getting it sent to me, but no, it never happened.
Well, I was going to send you the bootleg for lack of any I'll send it to you. Forget I said anything.
Okay, yeah. No, I was just waiting. You know, I just figured, okay, you know, I mean, you got more important things to do than send me something.
Here I am trying to be all charming, and it turns out I'm an asshole.
I haven't picked it up yet.
I haven't picked it up. I've been looking for it, and I got to tell you, you know, I haven't seen it, you know, so.
Well, you will see it soon. That's all
okay.
I'll say. So to answer your question, I mean, there are definitely sometimes, you know, like I kind of dealt with this when I was working with Amin on Abu Rad, where, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's some stuff where you look at it and you're like, it's hard to imagine saying it much better than that. I think for a composer to sort of try to find their voice and to be original is an important thing. It's nothing you can force, though. I mean, one of the valuable things I remember being told when I was doing my degree, you know, my education was when we would talk about notions of this composer's style and that composer's style, and then ultimately the question becomes, well, what's my style? And I remember one of my teachers saying,
yeah,
you know, that's for the critics and the fans to figure out probably after you die. And don't, if you think about it, if you overly stress about it, all you're going to do is make yourself more generic or something will be hindered, basically. The creative process, all the greats, or at least most of the greats in any art form in all of history, did not, like Beethoven did not sit there saying, is this better than Mozart? You know, is this, blah, 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 like, you know, what do you think Haydn is going to say about this? You know, like he was too busy writing, and and I think that's important. You know, I mean, I do take it seriously, and I do go out of my way to not, like, if I'm playing around with an idea, working on a score, and I think, oh my God, that's great. Fortunately for me, being the sort of music nerd that I am, if it ever sounds like something else, it sets a red flag in my mind, and I go looking into my iTunes, and then I'm like, God damn it, Jerry Goldsmith already wrote this one, and so then it's like back to the drawing board.
Right.
And I wasn't always like that, you know. There's an album that you can get on iTunes called Spirit of the Cosmos. That's all music I wrote as a teenager, where it was, at that point, I hadn't had any real formal composition training. It was entirely, you know, just learning by listening to basically Goldsmith and Williams, and I didn't even really listen to classical music until I went to college. And so it was, my entire education and knowledge of orchestration was informed by listening to film scoring. And so there are certain elements of it that are decent craftsmanship, or, you know, show promise, as people might say.
Right.
For whatever that, but it's like horrendously unoriginal. You know, it's like, it's hilarious how one piece after another is very derivative of very specific other pieces of music. You know, I'm able to sleep at night by saying, no, it's just how I had to learn, you know, even though in reality I do lose sleep over it because I'm like, fuck, so unoriginal.
Amin
loves to be like, oh, what's that Goldsmith piece you wrote? Love Field. You know, it's like, what can you do? It's in the past now.
I think your stuff is great, man. But how can, we're talking about Abu Rad and Grace, how can movie fans pick up those soundtracks? Will they be available soon?
Yeah, well, I'm still working out the details on Grace. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen on that. That's one of those situations that's kind of typical when you're working with a studio where technically it's their call. You know, they own the rights to do that, which is the normal way of it. And so we're actually in the middle, because the film had its, you know, theatrical opening this last weekend, and, mm-hmm. and was, you know, sold out shows and, you know, really, really hugely received and really positive, and so we are working to figure out those details. The DVD and Blu-ray will be out very soon, actually.
I think September.
I think it's like the 15th or so, and there's actually a really I hope it's good. I never saw the finished version, but there's a like a 15-minute featurette bonus feature that's entirely on how we did the score. It's actually a pretty loaded DVD. There's like 5 or 6 separate bonus feature documentaries, you know, about the various elements of making the movie. It was such a fun project, and everyone who worked on it just was so excited about it, and so kind of, you know, everybody was kind of working overtime. You know, it was one of those projects where everybody's sharing the 3 a.m. coffee and stuff, because
right.
we're all just happy. We were all just love the movie. I mean, Paul wrote a great script, and he's a great director, and we were really excited. But so that's great. Captain Aburrad is being released by BSX Records. They release a lot of Chris Young albums, and they're a fairly recent label in the film music world, but they've put out a bunch of releases, and they were real excited about it, and they've already basically finished, like, the artwork looks awesome, and I'm really excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
The artwork is great, and they remastered it, and it sounds quite excellent, And so it's my understanding, you know, today was I talked to Ford Faxton, who's the sort of lead producer there, and it should be showing up on their website and Amazon and places like that, you know, probably this week. I would, you know, today, tomorrow, Friday, somewhere in there, and then it'll, I think, start shipping in a couple of weeks. I'll shoot you an email to confirm, but it's my understanding that it'll be any day now that you see it.
Well, I'd love to let our listeners know so they can pick it up, and I'd love to pick it up too. But what's the company you said? BSM or
BSX? Their website is there. They were a soundtrack retailer that sold. They were an online, you know, retailer for soundtrack CDs that decided to form their own record label to release the scores that they wanted to see out there. And so it's kind of like a record. It's like a record company started by film music nerds like us.
Mm-hmm.
Who then decided we can take this nerdiness to the next level and start releasing these scores that we want to see out there.
Right.
And it's the same. Fort Thaxton has been, you know, behind lots of score releases over the years. Like all the Prometheus Records releases, you know, were his. It's, you know, their website is buysoundtracks.com. All one word, except that the tracks is T-R-A-X. So buysound, T-R-A-X.
Right,
and meanwhile,
okay.
And meanwhile, the two films, Captain Aburrad and Grace, they're in theaters now, New York and L.A., and getting great notices as they deserve to.
And if you have any listeners in Washington, D.C., Aburrad opens this weekend in Washington, D.C.
Oh, great.
And Detroit as well.
Definitely try to get to see that when I can. It's going to be downtown, so I'm definitely going to make an effort to see that.
Oh, that would be great. That'd be great. Make an event. Call everyone you've ever met. Fly your family in. This is what we do.
That's right.
And meanwhile, you can read more about Austin and hear some of his music at austinwintory.com. It's a great website. Before we let you go, give us a couple of more recommendations for some great scores out there, new or old or recently reissued.
Well, the classics. I mean, my two favorite Goldsmith scores are Under Fire and The Wind and the Lion.
Oh, The Wind and the Lion is beautiful.
Oh, it's amazing.
Absolutely.
In fact,
beautiful.
Nadim Sawalha, who was the star of he plays Captain Aburrad, he was Sean Connery's like sidekick in that movie.
That's a great film.
It's a very fun kind of old-fashioned romantic Hollywood epic, you know. And a score to match. You know, he should have won the Oscar for that, but he had the unfortunate fate of being up against Jaws that year.
I actually think that Sean Connery's, like, best performance. I still do to this day think that's his greatest role.
Really?
Yes.
More than Finding Forrester?
More than Finding Forrester.
It's more than Forrester. Actually, you know what? It would have been better than Finding Forrester, because it's actually not bad. I was going to say The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Or The Avengers.
The Avengers, there you go. Yes, where he disguises a teddy bear or something, if I'm not mistaken.
That's my barometer for everything.
I'll have to see it again, rather. I remember watching the movie, you know, years ago and loving it, but after having experienced Captain Abu Rad, it might be a little difficult for me to go watch Sean Connery play an Arab.
That's true. No,
but,
that's true.
We'll see. I don't know. Amin has sort of spoiled me, I think. More sort of refined knowledge, even if I am still an ignorant whitey.
Yeah.
So we got Under Fire, Wind in the Lion.
You know, both of those were recently reissued as well. Under Fire, Film Score Monthly put out, they reissued the old, soundtrack that had been out of print for years, and then I think it was Entrada, I can't remember which label now, did a two-disc of the original soundtrack release, which had, you know, I think it may have even been specially recorded, because back in the old days, you know, when they would record, they would make a separate, they'd do a whole separate recording session for the soundtrack. I think that was what was originally released, or something to that effect. And then also the original track, the big two-disc thing, it's great. But let's see here, recent? I mean, you know, we probably talked about this last time, but I'm still in love with Alexander Desplat's Benjamin Button.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Absolutely.
We had him on the show. We talked to him, and that was a big treat.
Oh, really?
He was wonderful. And his scores...
He's so smart, this guy. His decisions are so intelligent.
Yeah, and the score is so delicate and so beautiful, and it's amazing.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it to death. And, Amin keeps telling me to go pick up Largo Winch. I've only heard bits of it, but that may become my new recent favorite right away. It's like Desplat doing a James Bond film, at least if the first track is to be believed. It's like David Arnold and Desplat's love child. in the best sense, you know, it's awesome. I don't know, you know, other than that, let's see, let me think, what else have I bought recently that I liked? There's a song I recently was listening to the score to John Bryan's Synecdoche, New York. And there's a song at the end called Little Person or Little People that's kind of this jazz piano, very soft and simple. It's absolutely fantastic. It's so understated. I love it. It's the whole score was very interesting. He always is good, but
he's got a lot of good stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And this score was not like every track wasn't like, oh, okay, John Bryan, because you know when you're, it's like Thomas Newman when you're so distinctive. Oh, you know what? You know what my favorite score of the year is so far is Michael Giacchino's Up.
That's a great score.
Yeah, Giacchino.
That movie was so good, and
the
score added
movie.
So much without beating anything over the head.
You're right.
He's great. He's on a roll right now too.
Yes, he is.
He had quite a summer, right? And also, he was the music director of the Academy Awards too. So he's had a pretty solid 2009 so far. I actually, admittedly, was not as into Star Trek. I thought that score was not as good as it could have been, but he way over made up for it with Up in my mind. I mean, Ratatouille might still be my favorite score of his, but it's a toss up. It's so good, and it just fit the movie as well as any score could.
Right.
Well, this is fun to we brought on Amin, and we did a whole segment about soundtrack scores, and he went through his collection with us and everything. It was a lot of fun. Can we do that with you sometime in the future?
Yeah.
Dude, come on, are you kidding? What are you guys doing in a half an hour?
let's do that. I'll drop you an email, and let's find a time really soon to do that, because we love talking
about
this stuff.
You're opening Pandora's box, but let's do it.
Oh, it's too late. I opened Pandora's box long ago. I've got nothing to lose now.
So we'll do that, and we'll
that'd be great. I will kind of prepare and have an educated answer.
That sounds great. We appreciate your time so much, Austin.
Yes, thank you.
I appreciate, it's always awesome to talk to you guys, and, we'll definitely talk soon.
We'll do it real
Excellent.
Soon. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that's Austin Wintory. The scores for Captain Abu Rad and Grace will be available. Well, Captain Abu Rad will be available very soon, and hopefully Grace will follow very soon. But they're both in theaters now. AustinWintory.com. We'll put that up in the chat room. It's his website, and you can hear some great stuff from him. I love talking soundtracks. Okay, Sunday night,
it's
the big casino tribute with Frank Vincent.
Yay.
Forget about it. No, that's Donnie Brasco.
That's Donnie Brasco.
Which is another another candidate for the new classics here.
I think we could do it. I don't see why not. I mean, we're just going to do all these.
With that level of enthusiasm, dude.
No, the reason I say that is because, no, I have no problem with that. I know a lot of people go, you're only doing gangster movies or crime movies.
Oh, I see.
Movies. No, because I get these emails. You're only doing the things from the 70s. No, I'm all for Donnie Brasco because a lot of people, you never hear that film mentioned. It's always like, Donnie Brasco. They don't. It's a great film. I mean,
and that's a Patrick Doyle soundtrack, I think. Score.
I think you're right. And I would love, dude. I'd do it like in a half hour if you want to talk about it.
Well, we 95. We did Heat. We're doing Casino. We did McCabe. That's not a gangster movie. We did Gone with the Wind.
Yeah, I know.
We've
done
Spielberg's movies.
Yeah, I'm all for Donnie Brasco. I think that's an awesome choice. Really good choice.
We're throwing all these options up in the air, and our listeners are just going to be so surprised when we eventually choose, UHF.
I think that's coming. I think that's that or... I got to think of another one. Weekend at Bernie's.
Pink Cadillac.
Pink Cadillac,
Where did that come from? that's another show that we should do, where we just name random movies out of our heads. That'll be great.
That would be, yes.
As if we don't do that every show.
Yeah.
Speaking of Pink...
Do it. Just do it.
We're going to close the show off here with a little Pink, a little something different for you guys. We've had a great time. We'll see you back here Sunday night. Jerry, thank you, my friend.
All right, thank you. Have a good night, everyone.